There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name's Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host on today's program. The recording industry throws out a little bit of a concession to web radio, but they send it right back. And they're also trying to go after broadcast radio for some extra bucks. And we'll be getting into fair use and copyright, something I haven't talked about in the show in a little bit. It's all stuff that affects our daily communications lives. You do want to stay tuned. Well, a bit of a pitched battle has been going on between the Recording Industry Association of America and the organization known as Sound Exchange, which collects royalties on the playback of CDs for the internet and for other places where royalties need to be paid, such as for satellite radio. New fees that internet radio, web broadcasters, webcasters are supposed to pay were implemented this year by the Copyright Royalty Board, which is an arm of the U.S. Copyright Office, greatly increasing them, and especially increasing them for larger web broadcasters who might have more than one station, more than one channel going on, and really increasing them for small commercial webcasters by recomputing how those royalties get paid, thereby causing them to go up by as much as four or five times what they're used to being paid. Quite rightly so, the independent web broadcasters have been saying, you're going to put us out of business. Many of us barely make a profit at all, so the previous royalty computation rate, which made what they paid a percentage of their profits, so which seems very fair, other commercial web broadcasters would pay a percentage of what they make by being on the air. That's going away in favor of just a per song, per channel fee. So that, and per listener fee. So if you have a lot of listeners, but you're not making a lot of money, or if you have a lot of listeners and you're not making a lot of money, which is true for a lot of web broadcasters, maybe put out of business. So there's been motion in Congress. Two bills have been introduced in the House and in the Senate to try and roll back the rates to that percentage of profits methodology. Now to try and bridge the gap, Sound Exchange, which is the organization that collects the royalties for the recording industry, is trying to propose lower fees for small web broadcasters. These would be for organizations with less than $1.25 million in annual revenue. They would like to let those small broadcasters go back to the old way and pay royalty fees of 10% of gross revenues up to $250,000 a year, plus 12% of gross revenue exceeding that amount, and keep that in place until 2010. According to the general counsel for Sound Exchange, Michael Hoop, quote, the net result of this proposal is that small webcasters will be guaranteed no increase in royalty payments for 13 years from 1998 to 2010, end quote. But Jake Ward, a spokesperson for SaveNetRadio.com, says, quote, the proposal would throw large webcasters under the bus and put an end to small webcasters' hopes of one day becoming big. He goes on to say, under government-set revenue caps, webcasters will invest less, innovate less, and promote less. Internet radio would become a lousy long-term business, unable to compete effectively against big broadcast and big satellite radio. End quote. So this is only for the small web broadcasters, in which may be independent, and it certainly wouldn't apply to the large webcasters, be it like the radio services of Yahoo and others, who are banded together to fight SoundExchange in this. And we'll see whether or not Congress gets in on the act. And we're still waiting to see what this would mean for public and community broadcasters, non-commercial, non-profit broadcasters. Since we have become accustomed to in non-commercial radio having our fees paid by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in a lot of circumstances, those stations that receive CPB grants under a separate deal, which the CPB negotiated itself with the recording industry and SoundExchange. And still, that doesn't seem to be enough for the recording industry, because according to a recent article in the Los Angeles Times, the Recording Industry Association of America, along with the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences and the American Federation of Musicians, are now trying to get regular broadcast terrestrial radio to pay these royalties to them, putting pressure on Congress. Already, the U.S. Copyright Office has come out in support of removing the current legal exemption that says that broadcast stations like WEFT or the community radio station that you may be listening to do not have to pay royalties to the recording industry in exchange for the CDs that are played on air. Of course, broadcasters, including one of the largest lobbies, the National Association of Broadcasters, opposed this, whereas the Recording Industry Association of America is saying, well, satellite radio and internet radio have to pay these, so why shouldn't terrestrial radio have to pay these? According to Chris Castle, a music industry lawyer, quote, the old saying is that the reason broadcasters don't pay a performance royalty is there's a radio station in every congressional district and a record company in three congressional districts. But there's also an element in which radio has always seemed to generate more revenue for the National Association of Broadcasts, for the recording industry, for the RIAA, than it takes away in revenue, since if you look at how well the commercial broadcasters have worked in collusion, basically, with the record labels over the years for tight playlisting, top 40 radio, and for making sure that mega artists get played mega a lot, it would seem that radio play lines the coffers in the recording industry as a promotional vehicle much more than it would ever take away. However, profits are down, CD sales are down, music sales are down, and the recording industry is looking for other places to try and feather their nest. Now, this is not the first time that the recording industry has tried to get rid of the legal exemption which broadcasters enjoy in not having to pay for what are so-called mechanical royalties. Back in the late 80s, a group of singers and musicians led by Frank Sinatra tried to pressure Congress into changing the law. Broadcasters also prevailed in 1995 when Congress exempted from new fees for digital recordings that everyone else had to pay, which was the beginning of internet broadcasters having to pay royalty fees to the recording industries. What's interesting in all of this, and the recording industry's usual argument that it's collecting these fees on behalf of the artists, and it is getting many recording artists to join in the fight to get broadcast radio to pay these fees. What's ironic about it is that SoundExchange, the royalty gathering organization, apparently is having trouble finding lots of artists to give them payment, including what are probably major artists like Kraftwerk, which is a very famous, long-lasting German electronic band, the Dust Brothers, who make electronic music, The Far Side, which is a still active rap and hip-hop group. There's an enormous list, actually, that you can find over at Wired.com, listing all the artists who it seems amazing that SoundExchange can't find to pay their royalty fees. And after a certain point, if an artist can't be found, apparently, those royalty fees can get waived. And so they're certainly looking out for the artists there. And really, what is behind the payment of royalties to the recording industry for the playback of CDs boils down to intellectual property, something that gets thrown about in that term, and it boils down to copyright. That when you own the copyright in something, you own the right to control its use, its copying, and have the right to expect compensation for its use. You don't have to demand it, but you have the right to expect it. The reason why recording industry can collect royalties on CDs is that the in most cases a record label owns the right to the performance, and that's what it's called. It's called performance or mechanicals royalties. That's encoded on the CD. So actually, there's several layers of rights for a song. The person who wrote the song typically owns a copyright in that, generally through a publishing company, and can sell that to someone. So, and in sort of a famous case, the Beatles, Lennon McCarthy, owned the rights to the songs they wrote, which were eventually sold and became owned by Michael Jackson, who owns the rights to those, to the actual songs themselves, the actual words, and the music is written. But the performance typically gets owned by the record label, whoever funded the recording. So in many cases, artists who once had big hits and because they had a rotten contract no longer see royalties from their original recording, but who own the rights to the song itself will go back and re-record greatest hits packages, entirely re-recording it for a new label in order to try and make some money back on something which they're no longer making money for. So it's really an intellectual property issue. And so there's an interesting article that came down the pike from the tech news website ArsTechnica.com on May 20th, which involved writer Nate Anderson speaking with Mary Beth Peters, who is the Register of Copyrights, so the head of the Copyright Administration in the federal government, talking about the nature of fair use. Fair use is something in law, put into law finally in 1978, in the Copyright Act of 1978, defining how a work which is copyrighted, and since 1978, every single work ever created in the United States is instantaneously copyrighted the moment it's created, how a work can be used or reused or accepted or excerpted without obtaining permission from the copyright owner and therefore also not necessarily having to pay royalty fees. It's currently in Section 107 of the Copyright Act and has several factors that dictate when you can use things in a fair use fashion. Typically, it's for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research. And there's a four-part test about fair use, which takes into account the nature and purpose of the use, whether such use is of a commercial nature or for nonprofit educational purposes, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole, and the effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. And that last one is very important, because if you simply copy something all together, what is often called pirating it, and sell bootleg CDs on the street of albums available in stores, that is not fair use. However, the ability to create collage work, such as the collage band Negative Land does, can be considered to be under fair use. But what's interesting in this article in Ars Technica is that the Register of Copyrights, Mary Beth Peters, says that one big case which people look to in fair use is called the Sony Betamax case, where in the 80s, the Supreme Court ruled that Sony, by manufacturing video cassette recorders, was not violating copyright law, and that it was okay and, in fact, legal in fair use for individuals to buy a Betamax recorder and record programming for their own use. But what she tells Ars Technica is that the case, you know, the ruling there in Betamax case was actually very, very, very limited. She told them, quote, "It is not space shifting. It's not anything beyond that. It's not off cable. It's not off video on demand. And if you talk to most consumers, they think that anything to do in their home that comes through their television set is fair use." She goes on to say, "Once a court has actually handed down a decision with specific facts, if you fall within those facts, you're safe. But once you start wandering away from those facts, then I don't want to say it's a crapshoot, but it's not clear," end quote. And the point of the discussion here is to get at the use of DVDs, which you may or may not be aware are encoded, encrypted, with a schema called CSS, which prevents them from being easily copied. So that means for every commercially obtained movie DVD, to play it in your DVD player, that DVD player actually contains the decryption schema, which was licensed from the consortium of companies, including Philips and Sony, that put together the DVD standard. And if you do not have a DVD player that has a decryption schema, you wouldn't be able to watch it. That's why on a computer, usually comes with DVD playback software, but if somehow you got a DVD drive in your computer with no software, you wouldn't be able to watch the DVD. And that's why if you fire up your Roxio Easy CD Creator or some kind of copying software in your computer and attempt to just copy a DVD that you bought in the store, it's not going to work. Now, there is lots of software workarounds based upon something called DECSS or DCSS, which happened in the late 90s, that the someone reverse engineered the schema so that you could hack the DVD and copy it, or, for instance, play DVDs on computers for which no DVD watching software is available. Computers that use the Linux operating system, the free Linux operating system, there is no player, no legal player available, so you would have to use a hacked copy of DECSS in order to watch it. And a lot of the claims behind that have been that it's fair use in order to do so, or to be able to even rip DVDs. That's the process of copying it to your hard drive so that you can watch it, in order to take excerpts, or in order to make copies for educational use. A lot of people have felt that that's fair use. And what's news here then about this particular story is that Mary Beth Peters, Register of Copyrights, says that she does not think that that's fair use. And she says that one of the reasons why it's not fair use to rip is that she feels like, or she believes that the existence of this encryption on DVDs doesn't actually stop you from being able to make fair use of the content on the DVD. So, for instance, if you bought a copy of a recent movie, let's say Pirates of the Caribbean, and you want to take a small excerpt to use in some sort of either art or use in some sort of classroom circumstance, officially you would not be able to easily do this using your computer on your DVD. And there are workarounds to do it, and certainly you can use software which is not expressly legal to do so. And the Register of Copyrights is saying, well, that may be, you may believe that you have a fair use right to make that copy or to take an excerpt, but you are not actually exercising fair use rights by breaking the encryption. One of her claims is that, well, the movie is still available in unencrypted media. It may be, I would say, like a VHS tape, although those are quickly going away. I'm not sure that a lot of new movies are released on VHS, that instead you're just sort of, you have to accept that the quality won't be quite as good, but the material is there. On the other side of the argument, Fred von Lohmann from the EFF, from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has probably been the strongest voice in support of fair use, in support of individuals and consumers' rights with regard to copyright, tells Ars Technica that the ambiguity here that Peters pointed out, that really only a court ruling defines what's fair use, he says it's a bug, not a feature. It's not a bug, I'm sorry, it's a feature. He says, quote, Mary Beth Peters is correct that the Sony Betamax case is not clearly established that space shifting is a fair use. Neither does it say that it's not fair use. That's a question for a court to answer when the case comes up. Of course, these are both just opinions, neither of which are legal opinions from the standpoint that they stand as law. What's interesting about this debate is that I got forwarded this article about five times this week from all sorts of circles, because I work in educational media, and there are many occasions in which instructors of many different stripes, but especially those who work in media or work in languages or work in cinema and work in film studies, need to take clips from DVDs or take clips from VHS tapes in order to didacticize them, in order to pull them apart and use them for analysis in class. And it can be a very good teaching tool. And there are some, there's a law called the Teach Act, which provides some level of ability for instructors to do that, but a lot of them were kind of flipping out, worrying that some of the tools, so-called DVD ripping, that might be used to do that are not legal. And of course, the question is still up there. And that, certainly as a video producer in education, I'm constantly faced with having to make determinations of whether what we could do or are doing is legal and is fair use. And we do have some basic guidelines that we can follow that are established at, say, the University of Illinois by the library, and have been established by many other institutions. But something to keep an eye on. And the reason I keep an eye on it here in Media Geek is because I do think this is about our ability to create and use media. And these things can often have effects that are not at all predictable. And so you can say, well, oh, DVDs, okay, so they're encrypted. Well, that means that you can't play them if you decide to install a open, free, not bounded by intellectual property right laws operating system like the Linux operating system. It means that, you know, you're faced with this choice to either buy in or buy out of a particular system of intellectual property and rights. As you can see in radio, we're faced with the questions about whether or not there will be enormous fees for a broadcaster, a community broadcaster, a public broadcaster, or any broadcaster for in exchange for playing music on air. And I do want to point out, just as a sideline to this sort of discussion here, that radio stations do currently pay royalties to the songwriters, to the persons who wrote the songs. So, in fact, when it comes to broadcast radio, although performers, if they simply all they do is sing, do not make money directly from radio, the persons who pen the songs and own the copyrights on the songs are paid. Community Radio WEFT, where Media Geek originates, pays fees to ASCAP and BMI, which are two large songwriters associations that collect royalty payments on behalf of songwriters, and have so for quite some time. And it's a long-established practice with very, very reasonable rates. It's making it such that paying these rates is not a problem for Community Radio WEFT to continue to be on the air. It seems to be very fair in that way. And so I wonder whether the types of rates look that the RIAA is looking for will be nearly as fair. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. You can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. Some of these articles that I'm referring to are going to get posted in just a couple minutes. Those of you listening not in real time will already be able to see them, especially this article from Ars Technica. So you'll be able to go read it yourself, as well as I'll probably try to get the headlines up there. And this radio program can be downloaded at radio.mediageek.net. You can also subscribe to the podcast so the program gets automatically downloaded to your computer, your MP3 player. That's radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And a couple of good programs lined up for the next 2 weeks. Next week, Victor Picard will be my guest again. He's been in a couple times. He's a researcher and a graduate student in all sorts of media and communications policy. He's a fellow at the Illinois Initiative for Policy Research here at the University of Illinois. He did a stint working in Congress as an advisor on media policy. And he's currently working on his dissertation, his PhD, looking at journalism and especially alternative conceptions of journalism and news reporting. And so that's what he's going to come in and speak with me about next week. I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation and allow us to get a little bit off of the news stuff, although news is great and stuff, and help us sort of think more broadly about some things we take for granted about news reporting, about how it's done, and really question, you know, whether the way news is reported now is the way it's always been or the way it has to be. Really look at that fundamental question the same way we look at our commercial media and say, well, is it true that commercial media is the way it's meant to be, or the only way, or the way that it's that was designed in from the start, or is that actually the result of a lot of particular policy and other types of decisions that have ended up with the media system we have? Because once you can begin to see that there were choices that made your system the way it is, that you can begin to see their choices to reconceive how your system will be. And then the week after that, I plan to be speaking with Larry Block. He is doing radio, low-power radio, in Brattleboro, Vermont. He started out working with Radio Free Brattleboro, which was a non-licensed and unlicensed community radio station that was on for several years there until finally being shut down by the Federal Communications Commission a couple of years ago. It's something, this case of Radio Free Brattleboro, I covered many times several years ago on the show when the collective was very, very active. But now the folks in Brattleboro have a low-power community license. And are not just and so they lost their community, their unlicensed community station but now have a low power license to be able to continue to serve the Brattleboro area. The station is WVEW, and WVEW is actually playing the Media Geek radio show. So I'm certainly glad to welcome them along. I recently received word from them, and I thought it'd be great to talk with them about their station and the history of interesting community radio there in Brattleboro, Vermont. Because occasionally I like to hear these sort of stories, because every station, every media project is different, especially at the grassroots level, especially when you talk about community media. It reflects the community, and while there's a lot of similarities between stations, they're as diverse as the communities that they serve. And so it's always interesting to hear about another station and how they've come into being, how they manage to rally their community, and how they choose to serve their community through community radio, like we do here at Community Radio WEFT, where the Media Geek radio show is originated. That brings me to about the close here. One little note I wanted to make, it's a little bit of a policy thing here. It's interesting that 14 members of the Illinois Congressional Delegation, so for us here at WEFT, are many of our elected representatives, and this includes Senator Richard Durbin and 13 of the state's 19 House representatives, have asked FCC Chairman Kevin Martin to act on a waiver request from the Tribune Company in a timely fashion. Chicago-based Tribune Company has to file for transfer of control for applications of its TV stations as it moves to take the company private. Some of these stations have been operating under a waiver of the FCC's newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rules, especially in Chicago, where Tribune has long owned a TV station and the Chicago Tribune. What's interesting is the letter does not take a position on whether the waiver should be granted, but the legislators do point out that the FCC is in the midst of a years-long review of its media ownership rules. A Philadelphia Federal Appeals Court remanded its 2003 rule rewrite back to the FCC for justification, though it suggested that one of the FCC changes that appeared justified was maybe getting rid of the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban. Now, Senator Dick Durbin has typically been an opponent of media consolidation and been a big proponent of more democratic media. But it's interesting that they're sort of pushing this along. And it's just a little note to see how very political the process can be that oversees the licensing system, which until very recently, those licenses went to places like Tribune for free. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.